Early in the pandemic, health experts in China made an assumption.
As long as they vaccinate the younger generation, then the elderly might already be protected.
But that protection did not come, and China's elderly remain vulnerable to COVID. Also ahead in Libya, a desperate and dangerous cycle of migrants trying to flee by sea to Europe.
Where they try again and again and again to cross the sea, but instead they're returned.
I'm Carol Hills. Also, drug trafficking organizations in Colombia are finding new markets.
They don't want to export to the United States, where a kilo of cocaine is only worth between $20,000 and $25,000.
Much better money to be made these days in Europe, and a lower risk of getting caught. Plus, seagrass, underwater plants that could be a key to fighting climate change. Those stories ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. President Biden's first official trip to Asia is underway. First stop today is South Korea. Then on Sunday, Biden is off to Japan, where he'll meet with leaders from Australia, Japan, and India. This overseas trip is about shoring up American alliances in Asia and sending a message to one country in particular not to bully its neighbors. That would be China. The message Washington wants to send is clear. Don't even think about imitating Russia and settling disputes through military force. The big question, can President Biden get all of America's allies on the same page? The World's Southeast Asia correspondent Patrick Nguyen is following this. Patrick, first off, how is the Russia-Ukraine war casting a shadow over this trip?
Sure. Well, Biden really wanted to start the year by focusing on Asia. Instead, the White House has gotten completely bogged down by focusing on the invasion in Ukraine. So this Asia trip is an effort to say we can deal with the Ukraine crisis and pay attention to our allies in Asia at the same time and rally all of our allies and friends together to show China that if you were to threaten your neighbors the way Russia is tormenting Ukraine, you'll face our collective anger.
So it's kind of the walk and chew gum at the same time argument.
Exactly.
President Biden is now in South Korea. What are his goals there?
Well, first off, Carol, he's going to meet the new right-wing president, Yoon Suk-yeol. Yoon has campaigned on being Mr. Pro-America. His speeches are very pro-U.S. The U.S. has our back and we want them here and all that. He's also campaigned on saying we're not going to take any guff from China. The reality check is it is hard for a South Korean president once in office to act so tough because they have to deal with a giant powerful neighbor that is China. So Biden is there to say, don't worry, we got your back. And Biden also wants all of its different Asian allies to get along with each other and confront China as a team, especially South Korea and Japan. And these two countries are often feuding. Japan colonized South Korea last century and there's still bitterness there. Biden's argument will be, this is no time for any sort of bickering. Let's all focus on standing tall to China. And that really is the theme of the trip.
On Sunday, Biden goes to Japan, where he'll lead a meeting with the Quad, a military grouping of Japan, the U.S., Australia, and India. What challenges will he face there?
Well, I don't know if the Quad is a household name yet in the U.S., but it probably will be soon. It adds up to four countries that are all afraid of China's rise, but other than that, they really don't have that much in common. They're not even located very close to each other. So outside of the China issue, there are fractures. You know, the U.S. wants India to condemn Russia right now, and India says, no, Russia sells us weapons at a cheap price. We don't want to give that up, so you can drop that. But if you want to talk about teaming up to contain China, we're interested. And so Biden will find out in Japan when he meets with the U.S., Australia, India, and Japan, is this common fear of China enough to hold this group together in a meaningful way, and can they operate in sync on just this one issue and then disagree about other geopolitical crises?
How is China reacting to this trip? Anything in the press to indicate how it's being received?
China's refrain has been the U.S. is just ganging up on us. And as you know, most fears about China's expansion really move to focusing on Taiwan, the independent island that China's Communist Party would like to gain control of at some point this century. And the U.S. has specifically said to Beijing, you know, don't copy Russia and invade Taiwan or you will regret it. Recently, the U.S. has been more hands-on in helping Taiwan defend itself against such potential attacks. And the U.S. has urged Japan, a Quad member, to commit to defending Taiwan if it is attacked. Japan seems to be moving in that direction and getting on board. And China's response the whole time has been, this is raising the temperature in Asia, not what we're doing.
Patrick, what about North Korea? President Biden is in South Korea. North Korea is a perennial issue. How does that figure into this visit by Biden?
North Korea has been moving in a more provocative direction lately, doing missile tests. They've done more than a dozen this year alone. So it's very unclear if North Korea's COVID problems, they're having a very serious outbreak right now, will cause them to calm down. Either way, Biden in South Korea and Japan will be telling them, we want both of you to get along and we've got your back as you stand up to North Korea.
The World's Patrick Nguyen, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Carol.
China needs to end its strict zero COVID policy. At least that's what the World Health Organization says. But scientists say China could risk 1.5 million COVID deaths if it follows that advice. That's because, for starters, many of China's most vulnerable people are not vaccinated. The World's Rebecca Kanther in Shanghai spoke with a couple of her neighbors about why they're resisting getting the shot.
Over the last 2 months of lockdown here in Shanghai, I've been checking in on an elderly couple I've known for years. Wu Li Kai is 87 years old and lives on the third floor of an old row house with his wife. After a stroke last year, it's hard for him to walk. He can't go up and down the rickety staircase in their building. He says they're doing fine, just staying at home. I don't go out for the daily COVID testing, he tells me. Public health workers don't come up either. I do rapid tests on my own. We're staying inside, watching TV, listening to music, and having coffee and fruit. The main gate of the lane where they live is locked, and their children and grandchildren have not been able to visit since March. The couple relies on a live-in caretaker to help them with their daily needs. Wu's wife, Wang Yili, is 84. She's a retired public health worker. In normal times, she enjoys dressing up, doing her hair, and going out to shop for groceries. But not these days. We didn't get vaccinated, she says. I need to take care of my husband, and I was afraid of any side effects. The local neighborhood committee did call Wang to remind her to get the shot, but she says they didn't insist on it, so she never did. Wang and Wu are pretty typical. Less than 40% of Shanghai's over 60 population has been fully vaccinated. Jia Miao is a sociologist who researches Shanghai's elderly population. She says the fear of getting vaccinated is especially widespread among older people because they have a much higher rate of chronic conditions. Miao herself says she only managed to convince her mom to get vaccinated recently.
At the early stage of the mass vaccination, we have no idea whether it's safe enough for the elderly people. So at the very beginning, our government only encouraged the young adults to get the vaccination.
That's why a lot of older people still think it's better to avoid getting vaccinated. And China does not have a vaccine mandate. 87% of the general population in China are vaccinated. But some say the government has really dropped the ball when it comes to the elderly. Professor Jin Dongyan is a virologist at the University of Hong Kong.
Even the physicians, the healthcare professionals, and they don't feel comfortable to vaccinate the elderly. Initially, they felt that as long as they vaccinate the younger generation, then the elderly might already be protected.
But that is wrong, Jin says. And Hong Kong's experience proves it. The city has the world's highest COVID death rate, in part, he says, because of the low vaccination rate among its older population.
The most important lesson is to vaccinate the elderly as early as possible.
And give them booster shots as needed, he says. But across China, mass testing is the real focus these days. And nobody seems to be talking about vaccinations. I urge my elderly neighbors to be careful. I ask Wang, doesn't being unvaccinated worry her? I am worried, she says. But I thoroughly disinfect all the packages that come in our home. After the lockdown is over, we will just have to be extra careful. Wang and her husband have been through tough times before. They survived Japanese bombing during World War II and harsh persecution during the Cultural Revolution. For them, the pandemic is just one more challenge to face. For The World, I'm Rebecca Kanther in Shanghai.
On Monday, the Biden administration plans to dump a Trump-era border restriction. The plan, known as Title 42, prevents most migrants from crossing the U.S. border and seeking asylum. 20 states are now suing to keep Title 42 in place, and a federal judge in Louisiana has until Monday to decide. Jessica Bolter is an associate policy analyst with the Migration Policy Institute in Washington. Jessica, first, briefly, what does Title 42 do exactly?
Under Title 42, migrants who are apprehended crossing the border can be immediately returned either to Mexico or to their countries of origin. This means that they do not have access to the U.S. asylum system, even if they fear persecution in their home country.
What's been the situation at the borders since Biden announced April 1st that he was going to do away with Title 42?
The number of migrants crossing the border, it's near historic highs. There were more than 200,000 migrants crossing illegally in April, but it is a slight dip from March.
I'm wondering how federal and local authorities have been preparing for the likely end of Title 42 and an increased number of migrants coming into the U.S. borders.
It's really a collaborative effort between nonprofit-run shelters and aid organizations at the border, as well as local and federal officials. We will likely see local officials start to issue emergency declarations to free up additional state and federal funds. We may see some localities start to stand up city or county-run temporary shelters to also increase the capacity of nonprofits. And then the federal government has been increasing Border Patrol presence, expanding the capacity of the facilities where migrants are processed after being apprehended. They are creating new streamlined ways of processing migrants to try to prevent overcrowding. But there are reports that there is already overcrowding at some areas of the border, even with Title 42 in place. So this really may end up being a test of whether the administration can really activate its plan to scale up capacity and prevent overcrowding.
Of course, this is just this highly politicized issue. 20 states are suing the Biden administration to keep Title 42 in place. What's the status with the judge's decision, and what are we expecting?
There was a hearing in this case last Friday where the states that were suing the administration argued that the judge should block the administration from terminating Title 42. The judge has not ruled yet, but has said that he will rule by Monday when Title 42 would otherwise be terminated. The judge has seemed sympathetic to the state's arguments. So it seems likely that he may rule against the administration and we'll see this termination process paused in some way.
Jessica Bolter is with the Migration Policy Institute. She joined us from Washington. Thanks, Jessica.
Thank you.
Just ahead, we're seeing cases of monkeypox in unexpected regions. We'll learn what's behind the spread of that disease. And later this hour, an underwater grass that could help the effort to curb climate change. We'll head to Mexico for that story. You're listening to The World. I'm Carol Hills. You're with The World. Monkeypox cases are spreading across the globe. The rare viral disease, which is a cousin of smallpox, has now been reported in the UK, Spain, Portugal, and a few U.S. states. Monkeypox may be uncommon, but it isn't new. Nigeria has experienced monkeypox outbreaks for years now and records some 3,000 cases annually. With us to unpack the monkeypox outbreaks and the lessons from Nigeria is Christian Happy. He's the director of the African Center of Excellence for Genomics of Infectious Diseases and joins us from Nigeria. Christian, what is monkeypox exactly?
Yeah, monkeypox is a zoonotic disease that is transmitted from animal to human, but I think it's a disease that is very similar to smallpox. And it is manifested by a fever and an appearance of blisters on the skin and then, release of exudate.
Now, you mentioned that people get it from small animals or monkeys, I assume, but how is it being transmitted?
It's often human-to-human transmission through close contact with people that have infection. It doesn't transmit like Ebola. It doesn't transmit like COVID. It's definitely a disease that is transmitted through very close contact, that is having to touch somebody and having to have get in contact with the exudate from the blisters.
Now, from what I understand, the first documented case in the UK was traced back to Nigeria. What does that tell you about the global connections and how the world can address these current outbreaks?
I was speaking to a reporter this morning, and then they said, well, could he have come from Nigeria? I said, present the evidence. So I think we should be very clear. Yes, it is by genomic sequence data, it is a West African strain. But having a West African strain in London does not really mean that it came from West Africa. It's most likely, but who knows, maybe it's something that has been circulating there for some time. So we still need to do epidemiological investigation to really determine where that index patient came from and what was the contact, where did he get it from. People are quick to jump at conclusions. It's, oh, since it's a West African strain, it came from somewhere. We need to have that demonstration. We need to know where it's coming from. Nobody has an answer.
Whether it did or not, the fact that it's showing up in different parts of the world, what is the way to address these current outbreaks? What needs to happen to prevent it from spreading?
This is where, you know, there is a need to consult with public health officials in African countries that have experience in managing different kind of outbreak. What I've seen on the continent most of the time is actually isolation of index cases and then monitoring of the people that are in contact. And then in cases where you have smallpox vaccines, I think it is recommended that if you could vaccinate the close contact within days of being in contact with those people, that helps a lot. Because remember that monkeypox, even though it is a virus that is different from the smallpox vaccines are very effective against the monkeypox vaccine. And effectively, they shed the virus and eventually get back to normal.
And the person who has monkeypox virus, they should get the vaccine as well after they're cured?
Yes, after they occur, they should get a vaccine, because the cases in Africa often did not be translated in big epidemics because most people in Africa are vaccinated against smallpox.
Is there a global solution to this disease? I mean, how should the WHO respond?
First of all, trying to trace back and then see if there is a resurgence of monkeypox and what are the foci of that resurgence, and then go into the foci and then try to conduct what we call containment. I think, you know, there is definitely, you know, reason to worry, because we're in the midst of one pandemic and we have a disease like monkeypox emerging. But this also raises a whole issue about what I call global health inequity.
Christian Happy is the director of the African Center of Excellence for Genomics of Infectious Diseases. He joined us from Nigeria. Christian, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
In Europe, the market for cocaine is booming. European law enforcement agencies have detected record levels of trafficking and consumption. Authorities are struggling to stop the corruption and violence that comes with that. But as Tibisay Say reports, the solution to the problem might be in Latin America.
2 weeks ago, workers at an Nespresso factory in Switzerland were unpacking a shipment of coffee bags when they found a mysterious white powder inside. It turned out to be cocaine, as reported by Euronews.
It's definitely a big seize. It's really quite exceptional. It's the first time we've had such a find, 500 kilos.
500 kilos of cocaine is worth about $50 million. But just over a year ago, authorities in Belgium and Germany found 40 times that amount, worth billions of dollars. They called it the biggest cocaine seizure in Europe's history. And in both cases, the drug was coming from South America.
It's just another example of a concerted strategy, particularly by Colombian traffickers, to develop the European market and to grow their consumer base.
Jeremy McDermott is the co-founder of Inside Crime, a think tank that studies organized crime in the Americas. He says cocaine production in South America is booming.
Drug trafficking organizations led by the Colombians have decided they don't want to export to the United States, where a kilo of cocaine is only worth between $20,000 and $25,000. They are looking at more lucrative markets, like Europe, where a kilo of cocaine starts at about $35,000, where there's a lot less risk of interdiction, extradition, and seizure of assets.
McDermott says criminal gangs in Latin America are looking for new clients as far away as China, Japan, and Australia, where a kilo of cocaine can go for $100,000. Europe is becoming a global hub. Cocaine is shipped there first and then re-exported to other parts of the world. That's confirmed in a recent report by the European Monitor Center for Drugs and Drug Addiction. Laurent Leniel is a researcher with the center. He says cocaine availability in Europe is at an all-time high. One reason for that? The drug is now being processed in Europe.
European law enforcement in several countries has found laboratories processing cocaine base on European soil, with European criminals being involved in a lot of instances. It's not just European criminals, but also criminals from South America.
He says authorities have dismantled dozens of labs in Europe where people from Colombia were training Europeans on how to process cocaine. But what's most concerning for Leniel is what comes along with the drug trade, and that's corruption and violence.
Government officials, of course, police, judiciary, a private sector, port employees, airport employees, people from all walks of life can be corrupted by cocaine money. You know, more corruption, more violence.
He says drug-related violence is on the rise in Europe. But it doesn't compare to what people experience in Latin America, says Jeremy McDermott.
Like extortion, kidnapping, human trafficking, illegal mining, arms trafficking, etc. All of these criminal activities feed violence. And this is the reason that Latin America also dominates the list of the most violent cities in the world.
The war on drugs in Latin America has failed to solve these problems, according to Catalina Pinzon. She's an expert on drug policy reform at the Open Society Foundation. Pinzon says the people who get caught up in the drug trade are the most vulnerable.
This type of jobs is kind of an opportunity for a lot of people that don't have an opportunity. The more affected people are vulnerable youth, people of limited economic resources.
She says the best way to tackle the cocaine problem in Europe is to end the drug war in Latin America and reform drug policies. For the world, I am Tibisay Sea.
A lot of Ukrainians speak both Russian and Ukrainian, but when war broke out, many began reassessing what they speak.
Now I deliberately decided to speak only Ukrainian, because I do not want to be associated with Russian.
That decision was made on February 24th, the day the Russian invasion of Ukraine began. Language matters. Ahead on the world. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. Today is day 86 of the Russian invasion of Ukraine. The United Nations has confirmed 8,000 civilian casualties in Ukraine, including more than 3,800 deaths. The UN also says the real number is likely considerably higher. Most of the fighting that's going on right now is in the Donbas region in Ukraine's east. Here's Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky.
Там пекло. І це не перебільшення.
Жорстоке. Зеленський said the Donbas area is completely destroyed. It's hell there, and that's not an exaggeration. Joining me now is Alexander Kabiet. He's an editor with the Weekly Mirror, a Ukrainian online news publication based in Kyiv. Alexander, first, can you just paint a geographic picture for us? Remind us where the Donbas region is in Ukraine and why it's so important to Russia.
Donbas is the two provinces in Ukraine. This is consists of Luhansk Oblast and Donetsk Oblast, which were attacked in April 2014, where the Russian occupation of eastern Ukraine started. The Russian narrative claims that this region belongs to Russia, like historically and ethnically, and they say it's a liberation of the Luhansk People's Republic, so-called, and so-called Donetsk People's Republic. The militant groups control the territory since 2014 and completely controlled by Russia and created by Russia.
Have you been in touch with friends or anyone else who's currently fighting on the front lines in eastern Ukraine? And if so, what do they tell you?
most of the people there saying they need more armor in the Donbas to push Russian offensive back so far, but they are waiting for the armors are going to them, but Russia is striking the routes.
The U.S. has provided Ukraine with a lot of shipments of heavy artillery. As far as you know, have those weapons already been used on the front lines?
Yes, sure, and especially those M777 artillery systems. So I was talking to one source in Donbas in the military, and he said, like, it's a perfect weapon to repel the Russian attacks, but they need more shells for this.
Those are howitzers you're talking about?
Yeah.
Alexander, there are reports that Russia may try to annex some of the territory it now controls in Ukraine. The city of Kherson has been mentioned. Is this a likely scenario?
There are talks about this in Russian propaganda, Russian state media, and among the Kremlin men publicly. They are given the signals they are going to annex this territory. Of course, they don't use the word annex because they call it reunification with Russia, as it was with the Crimea back in 2014.
I'm curious, of the areas that Russia controls that it intends to annex, how is it trying to integrate those places like Kherson into Russia?
They already tried to make the circulation of the Russian ruble over there in those territories. They are blocking the Ukrainian internet providers and Ukrainian mobile networks. So they are replacing it with the Russian providers, with the Russian cellular networks. And they are opening the schools in the occupied territories. They open a school even in Mariupol. So they are bringing over there everything Russian, I mean, the books. And they are supplying the, for example, Kherson region, supplying with the foods and goods from the occupied Crimea. And the Ukrainian authorities, they say that Russia is artificially making the humanitarian catastrophe over there in Kherson region, especially because they do not allow volunteers to bring food, goods, and medicine to Kherson, and only allowing their own supplies to the major town in the South Ukraine right now.
How are locals there reacting to that? Are they accepting kind of this Russification of their area, or are they resisting and not using rubles and not going to these schools, etc.?
From the very first day of the occupation of Kherson, we see all of those footages of the rallies, anti-occupation rallies, and the people are going on the streets shouting Ukraine, Ukraine, and Russia, go home in Kherson. And we see those footages that Russian army is trying to oppress those rallies. The activists are disappearing. And it was also said today by the Kherson region governor, most of the people, they do not accept this aid from the Russia. And if they are working on the marketplace, for example, they do not accept payments in ruble, only Ukrainian hryvnia.
Today, Major General Kirilo Budanov, Ukraine's military intelligence chief, said that Ukraine will continue fighting until all Russian forces are kicked out of the country, including Crimea. Do you think that's a realistic goal?
Yes, and like every Ukrainian thinks it's a realistic goal, and not only the Ukrainians so far. So a couple of weeks ago, nobody was talking that Ukraine can win this war, and NATO General Secretary and the other high-profile officials in the world, they are saying, and the think tanks also, they are saying that Ukraine can win this war. So when Ukrainians see the victory for Ukraine as the liberation of every square mile over the square kilometer of the occupied Ukrainian territory, which includes Donbas occupied since 2014 and Crimea occupied since 2014, and also newly occupied territories after February 24th, like Kherson region, Zaporizhia region, and in Kharkiv Oblast as well. So this is definitely the perspective of the victory Ukrainians are drawing for themselves.
Alexander Krebyet is an editor with The Weekly Mirror, a Ukrainian online news publication based in Kyiv. He's been talking with us about the latest developments in the war in Ukraine. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Seagrasses are on the decline in the world's oceans. About 30% of the grass-like marine plants have disappeared since the late 1800s. That's a problem because they sequester carbon dioxide and provide a habitat for all kinds of animals. Off the coast of northern Mexico, the Comecac indigenous people have managed to protect the seaweed growing in their waters. And a recent festival dedicated to eelgrass has piqued interest in returning to the tradition of eating it. Sam Schramsky went to the festival on the Gulf of California and has this report.
At the two-day festival earlier this month, scientists, Comecac residents, and chefs came together to celebrate one particular type of seagrass that grows in the Gulf, called eelgrass. Laura Molina, who's Comecac herself, tells me how she remembers how her mom made tortillas out of flour ground from the seeds of eelgrass. They taste like a mix between wild rice and nori seaweed. With her, I learned about medicinal plants and the songs of plants, she says, as well as about traditional foods. But Molina hasn't eaten eelgrass since she was a small child, partly because it's very labor-intensive to harvest and process. Out on a boat in the Gulf of California, I go hunting for eelgrass with seasoned Comecac collectors. First, you have to harvest the shoots from tangled clumps of seagrass floating in the water. Then you dry the grasses, as Comecac leader Erica Barnett explains. Then you have to beat the plant so the seeds fall out of the shoots, she says. And you'll often want to toast the seeds before milling them into flour. Seagrass is getting a lot of attention these days because of its ability to store carbon. Estimates suggest it could sequester up to half the carbon stored across the world's oceans, which is a lot. One of its biggest boosters is represented here at the festival. Spanish chef Ángel León, at his restaurant Aponiente, has made it his personal mission to protect the threatened seagrass beds off the coast of his country. His representative at the festival, Greg Martinez, demonstrates how to make an eelgrass paella of sorts. León is interested in the plant's carbon sequestration potential, protecting the habitat they provide for animals and their use in the kitchen. The restaurant's conservation biologist, Juan Martin, says the hope is that if eelgrass becomes a sought-after superfood in Spain, it'll be better protected there. It's very nice that a guy with an apron, a cook with dreams, has done this, given glamour to a threatened species which currently lacks it, Martin says. In the Mediterranean region, including Spain, some estimates show that eelgrass beds cover only half of their historic area. Here in Comecac country, though, locals have done a much better job of protecting eelgrass. In fact, satellite imagery indicates that the plant has remained intact in more or less the same patches for the last 20 years. Ethnobotanist and writer Gary Paul Nabhan is one of the organizers of the festival. He argues that the Comecac people should earn money for the conservation work they do, much like certain landowners earn money for carbon credits when they preserve forests.
They have 96% of all the eelgrass habitat left in the Gulf of California. They're the original stewards of most of the eelgrass left on the coast of Mexico today. That means that whatever they're doing has been more effective than their neighbors.
Comecac leader Erica Barnett says before the festival, she was hesitant to process and cook with eelgrass seeds because of the amount of work involved. But now, she might consider reviving the tradition. My dad told me that he was 7 years old the last time he tried Sosteta marina, she says, using the scientific name for eelgrass. He said that he was very happy and proud of us having done this important work. It's like cultural rescue, she adds. Whether or not Barnett collects the tangled shoots along the coast again, interest in seagrass is likely to keep increasing globally. As the planet continues to warm, more people are trying to figure out how to boost the CO2 sequestered in the world's oceans. And seagrasses may be one solution that floats to the surface. For The World, I'm Sam Schramsky, Kino Bay, Mexico.
One of the world's most dangerous migrant routes is the one across the Mediterranean, from North Africa to Southern Europe. Since 2014, more than 19,000 people have gone missing, attempting to get to Europe by sea. That's according to the Missing Migrants Project, Our next guest, Sally Hayden, knows this crossing well. She's the author of the new book, My Fourth Time We Drowned, Seeking Refuge on the World's Deadliest Migration Route. She talked with the world's Marco Werman.
Sally, let's start with the title, My Fourth Time We Drowned. That's a quote. Who said it, and what were the circumstances?
Yeah, so that's a quote from a Somali refugee who is now actually in Europe. And so what he said was, I was caught by the Libyan Coast Guard three times, first time from Karabuli, East Tripoli, second time Zawiya, third time Zuwara, and my fourth time we drowned, and the fifth time I made it to safety. And the fourth time it was actually his family members that died. I mean, it's a sad quote, really.
I'm really tragic. And as we said, 19,000 people have gone missing. Now, Libya is really critical to the story of missing people. For your book, you spoke with hundreds of people attempting to migrate to Europe. It is a diverse group, as anyone knows who's been following this news. But can you give us a sense of where these people are fleeing from and what happens in Libya?
What you have is people from across the African continent, really, and actually some people from Asia and the Middle East as well. So they're fleeing, in some cases, dictatorships like Eritrea or wars like in Somalia, in Darfur and South Sudan. And then you have people from West Africa who might more be considered economic migrants, or in some cases also fleeing conflict or persecution. And they're all meeting in Libya, where people try and cross the Mediterranean to reach Europe. But what my book focused on was actually what happens after that point when they try to cross the sea. And they've been forced back into detention centers that have been compared to concentration camps by Pope Francis, among others. And so my book is based on years of communication with people inside those detention centers who had hidden phones, who were sending me evidence and communicating with me about what was happening there.
So sub-Saharan Africans, I know, have rarely found a warm welcome in Libya. I mean, what happens when they end up in these detention centers, and how long do they get stuck there?
So the detention centers are horrific. There's pretty much every kind of atrocity you can imagine taking place there. Forced labor, rape, other types of violence and torture, starvation, medical neglect. And the detention centers are being run by militias, and each one is kind of slightly different. And that's what I've tried to document in my book. One chapter focuses on, there was a person dying on average every 2 weeks from medical neglect and starvation. So that gives you an idea of the really horrific circumstances. Phones were prohibited generally, but they were desperate to make sure that someone outside knew what was happening. And that's why they'd risk everything to make sure that they had a phone that they could send out evidence on.
So how has Europe worked with Libya to stop these migrants from going to Europe?
Well, so what Europe is doing at the moment is both conducting surveillance above the central Mediterranean, so flying drones, helicopters, planes to spot boats of refugees and migrants, and then sharing that information, but then also training and equipping the Libyan Coast Guard. A European vessel basically cannot return people to Libya, but a Libyan vessel can. And so if the information is conveyed to the Libyan Coast Guard, which are being supported by the EU, then they can get those refugees and migrants and return them to Libya. And since 2017, more than 90,000 men, women and children have been returned in this way. The majority of them are locked up upon return. They're not charged with anything. They don't have any legal recourse. They're just locked inside detention centers indefinitely. And so we're returning people to a horrific situation.
Sally, as you explain in your book, your reporting started with a somewhat mysterious message you got on Facebook from a detainee in a Libyan prison. And from there, it led you to becoming a main repository of information about the brutality migrants face in Libya on this whole route. What has been the hardest part of being the intermediary between these voiceless people, and how has that impacted you?
Yeah, like you said, I mean, I just got a Facebook message out of nowhere. And it was from someone who was locked up in a detention center. He said a war had broken out around them. There were 500 men, women and children who had been abandoned without food and water, and they were desperately seeking help. And because I started gathering this information, I started both sharing it with NGOs, UN organizations, and, you know, anyone I could think of that would help. And for me, this isn't a story about you know, just about Libya. It might sound a bit specific or remote, but actually it's a story about how the rich world is kind of fortifying its borders and what is happening to the global refugee system more than 70 years after it was set up, the fact that people are being locked up for trying to seek safety. And in terms of the implications on me, I mean, I write in the book, I faced personal threats as well, which made me realize how important it is that this is documented. Like, I faced death threats, I was put under criminal investigation. Also, my sources, of course, were the ones who were really taking the biggest risk. They were risking their lives to get this information out. And that's why I hope listeners, they don't just think, oh, you know, this is another story about refugees, we've heard all of this before. Actually, like, this is really, really hard won information, and people risked a lot to make sure that it is known, and we haven't got accountability for what is happening there.
Journalist Sally Hayden, thank you very much for your time and for your reporting.
Thank you so much as well.
Sally Hayden's book about migration across the Mediterranean Sea is called My Fourth Time We Drowned, Seeking Refuge on the World's Deadliest Migration Route. Merchant mariners have been stranded on ships during Shanghai's strict COVID lockdown. Crew member Madeline Walchko works as a second mate on one of those container ships, and she's been chronicling the ordeal with photos and videos on social media. We have her story of being stuck in Shanghai's port for months. That's on our website, theworld.org. Language plays an important role in the war in Ukraine, like the way Russian President Vladimir Putin has challenged the validity of Ukrainian culture and identity. The question of language is unavoidable for Olga Parieva. She's a language teacher in Kyiv, or at least she was before the war. Now she's joined the effort to defend Ukraine against Russia's invasion. Laurel Chor of the PRX podcast Resistance Mother Tongue met Olga in Kyiv, where her volunteer group goes by a specific name.
They called themselves Palyanitsia, named after a traditional Ukrainian bread. The reason? In the early days of the war, Ukrainians were super paranoid about Russian saboteurs. So they would make suspected spies say Ukrainian words that Russians supposedly have a hard time pronouncing without an accent. Like, for example, Palyanitsia. Olga explained all of this to me. She's something of a language expert.
I've been bilingual since my childhood. My mom is a teacher of English, and when she taught me to speak, I started speaking two languages at once. And actually, it was not Ukrainian, it was Russian and English, because I'm originally from the East, and there we mostly speak Russian. Ukrainian was my third, actually, mother tongue. However, now it has become the first one.
Olga blows me away with her linguistic skills and knowledge. She speaks five languages and can talk passionately about the intricacies of each of them. At university, she studied German philology, the history of Germanic languages. Before the war, she ran a language school in Kyiv.
I'm a teacher of English, so this is what I do for a living. Currently, I'm a person who is doing everything he can.
Since the war broke out, Olga has had to reassess her relationship with the Russian language.
Now I deliberately decided to speak only Ukrainian. I mean, in Ukraine, yeah, and abroad as well, because I do not want to be associated with Russian.
When did you make this decision?
The final decision was on the 24th of February.
When the Russian invasion began, a lot of people's jobs came to a halt, including Olga's. So now, like seemingly every Ukrainian who hasn't picked up a gun, she's pivoted to volunteering towards the war effort, using her connections in eastern Ukraine to help move goods across the country.
What are you receiving and sending off today?
Receiving a couple of bulletproof vests and also a couple of those thermal scopes and different things that, you know, other people had a chance to buy.
So you've gone from owner of a language teaching school to someone who's delivering bulletproof vests.
This is something that everybody does now. I mean, we're all volunteers of any kind. For 8 years, I mean, I've been through this, yeah, and I've been in this.
Olga is originally from Luhansk. It's a city in the eastern Donbass region, which has been under the control of pro-Russian separatists since conflict began there in 2014. Many in the outside world think that this war began in February. But for Ukrainians, especially those from the east, it started in Donbas 8 years ago, when fighting forced Olga's family and over a million other Ukrainians from their homes.
How old were you then?
Oh, just a second, let me see. I was 24. It didn't, you know, make me another person straight away. Yeah, but it was the beginning of making myself a different person.
For Olga, part of this new person she was becoming meant leaving behind a language that no longer felt like hers. I've heard some people say that native Russian speakers in Ukraine now feel ashamed or even judged for speaking the language. I ask Olga about this.
It's not that they're, you know, being like suppressed, you know, or like they're being punished for something. It's, yeah, they feel this guilt because they associate Russian language with what is happening right now. Yeah, there are still people who speak Russian, and that's fine, as long as they do not associate themselves, you know, with Russia. So they are Ukrainians who speak Russian. This is okay.
It's not the Russian language itself that leaves a bitter taste in Olga's mouth. It's the brutality and imperialism it now reminds her of. Choosing to speak Ukrainian, then, is a personal act of resistance, a claim to Ukrainian identity, unique from the Russian one. But, as Olga tells me, there's more to war than words.
You know, language and identity, these are linked things, but an identity, yeah, is something more than a language. For example, now, Kharkiv, yeah, the place that is being shelled all the time, it is a Russian-speaking city. However, you see how people are pro-Ukrainian there, like how they defend their country, how they defend their city. That's why it's not only about the language. You can speak any language you want, but it's your deeds and how you act. This is what matters.
Olga has to leave soon to transport the bulletproof vests. But first, I ask her about the changes she's seen and heard in how people are using Ukrainian.
Well, it's everywhere. I mean, people are finally singing songs, not only at home, but, you know, in the street. My parents sing and I sing. And we've always had, you know, those family gatherings with Ukrainian folk songs and everything. But now people are bringing this further. I mean, our culture is everything we have. Our national identity, our history, yeah, and what is happening now is actually our newest history.
Singing in Ukrainian is now an act of defiance, a rallying cry. I ask Olga if she would sing me her favorite Ukrainian folk song.
This is a song about a couple in love, and the woman, yeah, the girl, is asking the guy, why didn't he come last night to her to visit? It's a story of the people who are like meant to be together, but there are some circumstances that like pull them apart. Чом ти не прийшов, як місяць зійшов, я тебе чекала. Чи коня не мав, чи стежки не знав, мати не пускала. Чи коня не мав, чи стежки не знав, мати не пускала.
That was Kyiv English teacher turned war volunteer Olga Parieva. She told her story to Laurel Chor of the PRX podcast Resistance Mother Tongue. The World broadcasts from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. I'm Carol Hills. Have a great weekend.